Welcome to Up to Date. I'm Steve Kraske. Matt Keenan has been writing about the beguiling world of teenagers, and more specifically, raising them, for the Kansas City Star and magazines for more than a dozen years. During those years, he has shared his struggles with certain teens, and by that I mean his daughter and sons, gaining the right to vote and what that means for the future of the republic, with teens spending too much time on cell phones and not enough time fishing or reading books. Matt Keenan hails from western Kansas. He was Governor Mark Parkinson's best man, and just in time for Christmas has a pair of books out, Call Me Dad, Not Dude, and Call Me Dad, Not Dude, the sequel. Later on this hour, the Star's Kevin Collison swings by to talk about the big changes in Kansas City's development world in 2012 and what lies ahead in 2013. But first, author and columnist Matt Keenan. And Matt, so good to have you here.
Thanks for having me, Steve.
Yeah. Well, you've been called a cuter, younger male version of Irma Bombeck. I get all of that, but cuter?
That's a tough one. You have to start on that question.
Yeah. Not really a question, just a comment. Yeah. I love what you write in the sequel, Call Me Dad, Not Dude, which is, you know, raising four children has been a joy, except you write when it's not. And there are times when you sort of wonder which side is winning, the joy side or the dark side. Are you sure the joy side has won out?
I think it's a moving target.
Yeah.
I think that certainly now that our sons are 23, 22, and 20, I think we are in some respects kind of past, I would say, the difficult times of parenting. I think that there is obviously a great deal of joy in raising kids, and my wife and I have shared much of that. At the same time, parenting is a real challenge these days. And what I've enjoyed doing in my spot as a columnist is drawing on the lessons from being raised in a small town in western Kansas. My parents raised me and my four siblings in a very laissez-faire way. Basically, every day they kicked us out the front door and said, come home when the streetlights come on. And our most important possessions were our bike, our baseball glove, and our baseball cards.
Mm-hmm.
And it was really a magical time. It was a time that I think a lot of readers reflect on, the way they were raised, whether they were raised in a small town or not. So much has changed since then. And in some respects, being a parent isn't a lot of fun. And one of the things that I am readily willing to admit is that I'm an imperfect parent, and it's okay.
Mm-hmm.
Parenting should be more fun and a lot less stress than most parents recognize. And I think when parents realize that they can relax, they can trust their instincts, it becomes more fun.
Yeah. Yeah. You make an interesting point in the new book, and you say that these days the only person with greater challenges than the parent is the teenager. And that'll surprise a lot of adults. Why is it a greater challenge for the teen these days?
Well, stop and think about it for a minute. When I was in high school in 1977, I wanted to go to KU. And back then, to go to KU, you basically had to have a pulse. They were obligated to take anyone who graduated from a Kansas high school. I don't recall taking the ACT or even the SAT. I certainly didn't study for it. You know, today's kids are tested constantly. They're prepared. They take preparation tests to take the test.
Tell me about it.
They take, the idea of going to KU or K-State, which when I grew up was essentially, you know, like going to Harvard or Yale.
Mm-hmm.
That's really way down their list of priorities. And so when kids reach the age of 18, I'm just talking about the academic challenges they've had. They've had AP classes. Sometimes they've taken 4 years of foreign language. My sons took 4 years of Spanish at Rockhurst.
Yeah.
They have been drilled and tested endlessly. And that there's a whole lot of stress associated with that. And that doesn't even get into the athletic side of the equation.
So do you think we put too much stress on them these days? Because there's this big tug of war in society. We don't make them do enough. We should have them do more. And it's always going back and forth.
I think it's a legitimate debate. I think in the case of our children, I think we push them too hard. And I think I can say that. Now that in some respects the canvas has largely been painted and we kind of know what kind of children they are, what young adults they are. I mean, I think that it's difficult for parents because it is a competitive world. It's a competitive world. And when you're looking at, 10 million people who are unemployed, you want to raise your kids with the tools so they can be competitive.
Yeah.
In 1977, it's probably a poor comparison because in my high school class, I think four people were going to KU. About 10 were going to K-State. There wasn't, people were content to go to JUCOs, in some cases not go to college at all. so much has changed since then. And so it's a struggle, and it's hard, I think, for parents to find the right balance.
You know, your most recent book talks about your high school senior having turned 18 just before the 2008 election when President Obama was elected, and you were struggling with this idea that his vote could cancel yours out. Can you turn to your column that you wrote about this, Matt, and just read a little bit from that column for us?
Sure, I'd be happy to. This is from a column that ran, I think, and it was in October of 2008, and it involved a discussion that I had with my, at that time he was a high school senior at Rockhurst, about him voting. And it went like this. He said, I can cancel your vote, Dad. That would be hilarious. I shifted uncomfortably in my chair. Really? Maybe I'm weary, but there's something wrong when someone who has never turned off a light should be able to vote on the basis of being green. Someone who never thought about the gas you burn driving to Chipotle should vote on the basis of energy policy. Someone who's rejoined every Friday night when I remind you of your curfew is, quote, are you serious, close quote, can have a substantive appreciation of the issues. I mean, this may surprise you, but the Surge is not an energy drink. Freddie Mac is not a new menu item at McDonald's. Leaving your sister at last week's football game is not the same thing as No Child Left Behind. I was just getting warmed up no matter. He was making a phone call, but that changed in a hurry. I told him, you'll still have a midnight curfew and your car's on empty. I woke up in a cold sweat.
How did he – vote the way you wanted him to vote that year?
Yeah, he came around. I think he was pulling my chain. I mean, 18-year-olds like to find leverage points with their parents. And so when he that was a huge leverage point for him.
Yeah. Over the years, you've also developed what you call your own teen misery index. Number one on that list is raking leaves, which I can relate to myself. Why raking leaves?
Well,
so true.
Anything done outdoors in the sun the whole teens and summer jobs has been fodder for multiple columns because, of course, like most 53-year-olds, when I was a high school freshman, junior, and senior, we all had summer jobs. In my case, I was working for the street crew, the Great Bend Street Department. And, you know, it was 110 degrees in the shade with no shade.
Yeah.
These days, the notion of kids mowing yards, forget it.
Yeah,
forget it. Unless it's a riding lawnmower with a cab with air conditioning and XM radio. I mean, kids working, essentially sweating and doing manual labor is
it's
really
just sort of out the door.
It is totally. But
you ended your column about the whole notion of raking leaves being number one on the teen misery index by saying it's fun to watch their last 2 hours of work disappear with the first big wind gust.
I can't admit to too many occasions where I've successfully got any of my sons to rake leaves. They would tell me, why do I need to rake leaves? I've never seen you do it. And that would be true.
You also talk about, on the list of teen misery index, the importance of using old fogey language when teens want something because it makes their veins bulge. What do you mean old fogey language there, Matt?
The classic one is when I was your age.
Yeah.
Any sentence that starts with that.
You're done.
Right.
Doesn't work.
Right. Old fogey would be, let's see what's on the FM dial. We're going to go on a road trip to visit some of Missouri's or Kansas parks. Okay.
Yeah.
No.
When we get in the car and it's Saturday evening, I'm taking my son somewhere not old enough to drive. Invariably, I have Prairie Home Companion on because I'm from Minnesota and I've always connected with that show. Boy, talk about making their veins bulge. That show drives my 14-year-old absolutely apoplectic.
Yeah.
You know?
Well, it's interesting because, As one of five children, we took road trips all the time with our parents, and we always sat in the back seat. There was never any air conditioning, and there was no room for dissent. Period. You did not dissent. It was my dad's way or trailways, and none of us liked buses. Okay, and it's so interesting how you get in the car these days, and the kids argue about who's going to sit in the front seat. Now that's kind of old. That's old fogey perspective. When I was your age, you know, and these are kind of occasions when even my wife was going with us, and she would, you know, they like to throw it out to see if it'll stick on the wall, and if it does, they get a ride in the front seat, which means they get to manipulate the radio. Most of the times, they say they get it. They go, no, get in the back, and that's fine. But It's I get my sons back and daughter back to my hometown frequently, and my dad's 83, and he's still doing very well. Mm-hmm. And I love for them to spend time with him
and get
their perspective.
I get that.
This is a man who was 6 years old during the Dust Bowl, 1933.
So he remembers it.
He does. He does. He grew up on a farm. And he tells these stories, and their eyes get wide, and they listen, and they respect the fact that it was, I talk about what a different time was for me when my dad talks about growing up. They really understand how different the world was then.
A very different time. Yeah, we're visiting with Matt Keenan. He's a columnist for the Kansas City Star. He writes about raising kids. His latest book, Call Me Dad, Not Dude, the sequel. Matt, how did you get started in all of this? How did you get started writing the column, writing the books?
It went back to October of 88, and at that time I was writing the newsletter for the Cub Scout pack, and I was writing a newsletter for the baseball team. And this was right at the advent of computers and home printers, and I had programs where I was able to produce these newsletters. And this was an exciting time for technology, and I would hand these things out during the pack meetings, or I'd hand these out during the baseball games when, little Johnny was, facing his 15th pitch. And my wife said, you should write in a way that's really funny, and the paper could use someone like you. And at that time, I went to the paper and I knocked
on the Star.
Yes, I knocked on some doors, and was persistent. And
they said, "What do you want?"
Yeah, exactly.
What are you here for?
Yeah, I said, they said, "You're not a journalist; you're an attorney." And I said, "You're right, but I can." I said, "Give me a chance, and I won't disappoint." This was back in the. My editor at that time was a guy named Jeff Gerber, and they ran me in the Johnson County insert, and that was October of 99, and I've been publishing twice a month ever since.
What kind of feedback did you get? What kind of feedback do you get now?
It's interesting. I used to get a lot of feedback. I used to get anywhere from 1 to 7 to 10 emails per column. I don't get nearly as much feedback anymore. Part of that, I think, is changes at the paper. But generally, if you make somebody angry, they'll send you an email.
And I
don't do that. I don't write in a way. I leave that to other people. I try to write non-judgmental, non-critical commentaries about raising kids in a way where if somebody is going to be made fun of, it's going to be me.
You know, when you were raised in Western Kansas, you were raised with a guy named John Holt, the anchor at Fox 4. And what a great guy, right?
John was...
Tell us about John, because people know him so well around here.
Well, John and I, we grew up two doors down from each other. We went to St. Pat's together. We were taught by the Dominican nuns at St. Pat's in Great Bend. Great Bend has a Dominican convent there, and I grew up across the street from that. And so there was a large population of nuns there, and they taught at the school. And John was, when John was 8, he acted like he was 18. I mean, he always had a great deal of maturity for his age. He was extremely responsible. And, of course, because he was my best friend, it helped my parents sleep at night because they knew John was my wingman. I mean, he was kind of a living, breathing guardian angel.
Yeah.
And we went to KU together. John's dad was a legacy at a fraternity there, the DU House. I was kind of the player to be named later.
worked out.
It did. Mm-hmm. They took John, and I went with him, and we lived in that house for 4 years
together. You guys sort of said, if you want one of us, you got to take both of us,
they wanted – John was a done deal because John's grandfather was a DU. His dad was a DU, okay? And then John had two uncles that were DUs too. I mean, John was a lock. I mean, he was like – he was a 5-star can't miss kid, and then I was the guy picking his nose in the back of the room. They said, "Who's this guy?"
You got to take him.
Yeah,
too.
And so we lived in that house together, and then we went to law school together too, and we were roommates for 2 years of law school. And John and I, John's parents, Jack and Charlotte, are still dear friends of my parents, and so John was my best man at my wedding, and John's daughter Katie is our goddaughter, and Maggie is godchild to Jack. To John and Susie.
And speaking of best men, Matt, you were also former Kansas Governor Mark Parkinson's best man at his wedding. I always liked that guy.
Mark and I started in the summer of 1981 together at KU Law School, and the summer program had about 50 students. And so Mark and I became friends that summer, and that's where Mark met Stacy. And we were dear friends for 3 years. And Stacy's dad was very sick with cancer, and they wanted to get married before he passed away. And so they had a wedding, a very, very modest wedding in Topeka. And I was privileged to be a part of that.
And he's out east these days.
Yes,
right?
He's in Washington D.C. He's working with a group involved in assisted living centers, and because Mark and Stacy had
that's what he did here,
right?
Yeah, before
right.
he became governor.
Right.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, you've written about your college-age kids coming home for Christmas break from KU for these, what you write are these interminably long vacations that can stretch up to, 5 weeks, right?
Yeah.
I'm guessing you're right in the middle of that right now, maybe with at least one or two of your kids. Why do colleges give such long winter breaks?
It's a mystery to me, really. Those college breaks, there's about three segments. The first segment is they come home, and it's the prodigal son has arrived.
Yeah.
The fatted calf is slayed. Everybody has a good time. You have huge meals. Everybody stays home,
mm-hmm.
hugs and kisses,
yeah.
and they say all the right things. The middle part is when they start to get restless.
Mm-hmm.
They want to go see their friends. And Mike, that's one of the struggles we have is when they want to go see their friends, it could be 15 miles away. I mean, they're not down the street. Okay, their friends are in Midtown or Brookside. And so they're in a car and they're driving.
Mm-hmm.
Now, invariably, they're driving when the weather's turning bad.
Yep.
You name it. They've got their phone. You know, there's a lot of bad things that can happen then. The third phase is they've seen their friends. They've been there, done that. The third phase is they want to start getting back to school.
They want to go rough around the house.
Yeah. They want to
go. The rules don't hold anymore.
No. They're ready to get back. They're ready to get back. They want to go back. They want to go back to a place where there's no rules.
Yeah.
And
are your kids home now?
We have actually yesterday our second son left to drive to Dallas. He's going to work as a intern for KPMG. He's an accounting student at KU,
mm-hmm.
and so he left yesterday. Our third son is leaving tomorrow on a ski trip. That's one of the big boondoggles, of course, is the universities. They get these either informal or formal arrangements with these with the Colorado ski resorts.
Oh.
And they organize these trips with the students. And so he's leaving tomorrow to go to Colorado with a whole huge consortium of KU students.
Mm-hmm.
So he'll be out of the pocket for about 5 days. And our oldest.
That'll help.
That will help a lot. We're ready. I think my wife is packing him right now. And our oldest son is working now in Madison, Wisconsin. So he graduated. He's gainfully employed up there.
There's my alma mater up there. I really got a kick out of your 2009 column, Matt, about coaching, if you can call it that, I guess, your son's Sluggers baseball team. What made that team so special to you? Because this is such a great story.
Well, I think I counted the other day that our three sons have played nine different sports. For my second son, the baseball has really been his love, and he played it most of his teen years. The Sluggers was an occasion for Tommy to reunite with a lot of the friends he had from three different high schools who had played high school ball at various times, but for various reasons weren't playing baseball anymore. And so it was a chance. I said, Tommy, if you get the kids, if you enlist the roster, I'll coordinate and I'll be the coach. And we didn't have any practices. We just had games. And it was
– Why was that?
Because this was when they were 17 and 18.
And practicing is not like something they want to do.
No, no.
Why make them do it?
And a lot of them had summer jobs too. These were when they were in the high school, somewhere between their junior and senior year. It was a blast. It was a total riot because if you can get kids that age to put their phones down, if you can get them to grab their baseball glove, if you can get them to tuck their jersey in for 2 hours, you can have 15, 16 games. In some respects was like a time machine for me. It was taking kids back to the days that I enjoyed so much in 1974 and 73 when they're playing a sport. That's the best sport in the whole world. It's a sport. It's a summer sport. It's a social sport. It's a fun sport. And That was probably one of my best memories.
And these are kids, this team, you kept them together for a number of years. I mean, so many teams these days, at least my experience has been, they sort of play together for two or three years, and the best kids get picked off to go play for some other team somewhere. And sort of that fellowship, that camaraderie gets broken up along the way so much these days.
I think I think if today's parents are subject to criticism, I think it's how so many of us handle sports. And I think cherry-picking kids and taking them off their neighborhood or school or parish teams and putting them on traveling teams, yeah, I think is the biggest mistake. And it's a mistake we made, too. We made that decision for 2 years with one of our kids, and he played 55 games in various cities. And, you know, there was some definite good there. I mean, he made friends with some super kids, yeah, kids who went from high schools all around the metro. But bringing him back to that Sluggers team and reuniting with a lot of his friends was a wonderful reunion. And I think being able to coach a team that is competitive, that is fun, that brings people together, brings parents together. In some cases, these were kids whose parents were divorced, and the mm-hmm. only time they would be together would be when they would sit in the stands and watch their son play. Great years as yeah. a parent, and I know that my son has told me that those were some of the best times he had in his older years. And so, sports and I think it's difficult too, because parents have there's a lot of tension in those decisions. You want your kids to be active. Mm-hmm. You want to get them off the couch. You want them to be involved. But striking the right balance is hard yeah. for a lot of parents.
How difficult was it for you and your family to sort of say goodbye to the Sluggers once the time finally came?
It was very hard. It was very hard. I will tell you, we just recently moved out of our house, and I went down the basement, and I found bags of gear and helmets and balls and bats that – I mean, it was very emotional for me, because – these were balls that had been – you look at the balls, and they had the wear and tear of games and practices. And it was very hard. It was very hard. I gave some of the balls and bags to a neighbor of mine whose son is in third grade. Mm. And he loves baseball. And I went over and gave those to him. And it was really cool to kind of pass the baton on.
Again, we're visiting with the Stars, Matt Keenan. You know, how difficult is it to write a column that's a humor column? I mean, I write stuff that's, you know, serious and sober and somber and all this stuff. And you're writing a column that's designed to, you know, promote a few chuckles and laughs along the way. It strikes me as very difficult to do and do it well.
It is hard. I had someone tell me, who was very knowledgeable about the writing business. He said that to be a Dave Barry is like it's harder than being a Michael Jordan. Hmm. That it requires so much ability, because nobody likes somebody who thinks they're funny and they aren't, okay? And to write in a way that brings a smile to people's faces, it's hard. It's hard. I mean, there's sometimes I have nothing. I mean, today I have a column in it's in the JOCO 913 section of the paper, which talks about we got a storage unit. We had to get a storage unit because we moved out of our house. And it was my job to fill it up, and I'm not really, or being organized isn't my strong suit. So it's basically jammed with crap.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it's a funny piece, but I don't know if people will resonate.
How do you know if it's working? Do you bounce it off your wife? How do you make
it work?
I do.
I bounce it off her, and she shoots down more ideas than she embraces. But
that's what wives do.
I mean, yeah.
I've had that experience.
Yeah, it's. I don't know. It's. Sometimes my editor at the paper, Grace Hobson, will say, "This is good. It's a good one. That's a good one." But when you don't get any reader feedback, when you don't get a single email from anybody, you go, I don't know.
You wonder sometimes, don't you?
You do. It's just like what you do. I mean, yeah. You just – is anybody out there? Is this a piece that resonated? I try to read the New York Times and try to be current on whatever
is happening.
Yeah, exactly. Mm-hmm. I mean, the whole storage unit thing with storage wars, and that's kind of a – and I went on the news and looked. And so I think that's kind of in the mainstream. But yeah. I don't know. I wrote a piece one time about all of these people that put the little advertising signs on all the intersections. you know, will mulch your yard.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
I thought it was just right on. These signs are everywhere.
They
this
are
is
everywhere.
Right before Christmas, people are wanting to put up Christmas lighting. And I loved it. My wife loved it.
Mm-hmm.
It ran. I didn't hear from a single person.
It makes you feel bad, doesn't it?
It does.
Yeah, yeah. Well, what's going to happen when the kids are sort of older and all gone out of the house? And then what's the future of Matt Keenan's column?
Yeah, I don't know. I really thought about that. I mean, I think the parenting thing, it's writing what I know. And it's definitely, it's, you know, I mean, one of our sons has been in Madison for a year and a half. And he's kind of off the grid a little bit. I mean, we call him, we talk to him, of course, and email him. But I don't know. I mean, it's a topic and under discussion right now. I mean, I enjoy my spot in the paper, and I think the paper's done a nice job of promoting me. And but you know, I don't know what the future is there either. So we'll see.
Well, Matt, it's been a pleasure to have you.
Thank you for having
me.
So
good of you to come in.
Thank you. And my book is for sale.
Yeah.
At Barnes & Noble, and at the Kansas City Star's bookstore on the Plaza.
And that book is titled Call Me Dad, Not Dude, the sequel, right?
Yes, and I have a website, MatthewKeenan.com, where I post a lot of my current columns, and some of the columns we discussed are on there.
All right. Well, Matt, a pleasure. Thanks for coming in.
Thank you, Steve.
Again, that's Matt Keenan, his book, Call Me Dad, Not Dude. I'm Steve Kraske of the Kansas City Star, and you're listening to Up to Date on KCUR. We'll be right back.